Okay, let me try to give you a quick overview of research and where all these technologies are going and sort of bring us then to the final Q&A in the end of the session. Let me begin with sort of a geographic map of our research locations. As I said this morning, this is one of our 12 of our research labs around the world, three which opened in the last couple of years. Now, one way to think about this geographic map and history of IBM research is sort of the first wave were the big research labs in New York and Amadon, where we in Europe, where we built our research labs close to major universities, the Stanford universities, the ETHs, the Columbias, et cetera. The second wave in the 90s was in India and China, where we had tremendous growth opportunities, and we wanted to be part of that and lead IBM into those areas. The third wave, I would say, are the new laboratories, where we literally are going out into these markets, not to necessarily be close to a major technological university, but to go where the problem set is. So we go to Brazil because of the natural resource management, because of the opportunities in pre-salt oil drilling optimization off the coast of Brazil. We go to Kenya because of the types of problems that are unique in Africa, and as Ginny mentioned, the data, the sparsity of data, the difficulty, and the degree of difficulty requires a different kind of solution. So the third wave of our laboratories around the world has very much been around go where the big problems are, particularly the big data problems. Now, we talked an awful lot about this morning, but let me just sort of drive this thought home. What's happening here in this era of big data is not something we've ever seen before. We have the confluence of a number of explosive growth things going on. Mobile devices, exponential growth of billions of mobile devices, exponential growth in the internet of connected sensors and things, exponential growth, super exponential growth in social networks. All of those exponentials coming together, the barrier of entry being lowered by things like cloud enablement, and we're seeing this data grow at rates like we've never seen before. And what's interesting here, when we think about where we've seen exponential growth before in the IT industry, Moore's law, hard disk drive density, all of those reach physical limits. We see no physical limits to the growth of this data, as I showed you this morning. So that is really the core of the opportunity and the challenge for us going forward. Now, in order for us in research to go after these, not only do we have to be geographically dispersed, but we really do need to work closely with clients. And hopefully you really saw that in the innovation gallery out here. The discovery gallery. We must work with clients. There's no way to work on big data problems in, you know, large mining equipment other than to be in a mine in Australia, as an example with Thiess. There's no way that we can really do high volume data in motion, big data in the telco industry unless we're on the ground with Airtel in India and in Africa, where the data is, where the problems and opportunities are. So when I talked about sort of the three waves of our research labs, there's sort of a fourth wave, I would say. And we're going from the world is our lab to the client is our lab. And that's because they have the data. We talked at lunch at my table, you know, where do you get this data? It's the client's data. And because IBM is viewed as a leader in this space and a trusted partner, they share their data with us. So the client is becoming our laboratory. So when I start to think about our global footprint for research, I think more in these terms than I do our geographic locations of the past. And again, you know, I think about the work we're doing in Lawrence Livermore Lab down the road here in Livermore. I think about the work in Australia with Thiess around the country, EBX around the world, EBX in Brazil. This is the research footprint for IBM. Now, we talked about the eras of computing, and just to recap and sort of position well what I'm going to talk about next, we've gone from the tabulating era through this programmable era, and as Ginny articulated this morning, we've gone through these waves in this programmable era, which we've been in for the last 40, 50 years, where we've captured various points throughout this, but we're now in this sort of transition phase from this programmable era into the next era of cognitive computing. And it's being driven by this big data, this confluence of all of these sort of exponentials coming together. So everything we're doing today, everything you've seen from the divisions, is addressing this big data at this transition. So we in research then are focused on how do we take programmable systems we have, optimize around that big data, how do we extend that era, and then just as important, how do we look over the horizon at this new era of cognitive computing, and how do we drive that forward? So the rest of what I'll share with you right now is what are we doing now in that big data space? What are the key technologies that are required to extend this sort of programmable era, and then how do we phase over into this cognitive era? I would argue that there are five key technologies in this big data space, and they're at all levels of the stack. And let me sort of start from the top. This data, I said, is huge. Much of the value in the data that we're finding is in the context of that data, the relationship between data points. That's where the value is being extracted. So contextual analysis of big data and machine learning applied to that is sort of the first big thing. The second big thing is visualization and analytics against visual information. We were intentionally showed you a lot of visual information in the laboratory earlier today, and that's because the eyeball is still the highest I/O bandwidth into the brain. And so with this massive data, we need to visually display this data, point number one. Point number two, a vast majority of the data that's being generated now is images, whether it's the medical field or videos on the web. That data must be analyzed. That is a difficult technical problem. But we've moved from tabular data to text data to this image data that needs to be analyzed. So the visualization of this data and the analysis of image data, is, I would argue, is the second big thing. The third, we talked about this environment has to be software-defined. It's just changing too rapidly. It cannot be, humans cannot intervene with it at the rate and pace of a mobile transaction. So these things have to dynamically optimize themselves. Fourthly, systems have been designed for the past several decades processor-centric. Systems of the future have to be designed to be data-centric. And those, I'll show you in some charts here in a minute, those are different kinds of systems. And just stuffing more processors in a sheet metal box is not the way to go after a data-centric computer. And then fifth, as we're extending silicon technology, we will, in the next decade, reach the limits of that. And we do need brand-new technologies to break through the barriers that we're experiencing in silicon technology. In IBM and IBM Research, we're working at all five levels, but we must make significant progress at all five levels. So let me start at the top and sort of work my way down with examples of these. Contextual analysis and learning. One of the demos you saw out there was in drug discovery. I don't know if you sort of caught the importance of what was going on there or the size of what was going on in that one application or solution. But you're dealing with millions of patents, millions of chemical formulas that these systems are analyzing and looking for connections between proteins and molecules for potential drug discovery. That is an enormous data problem, and it's looking for relationships, context between a protein and or a cancer and a chemical, whether it's been patented or not. Those are the kinds of contextual insights that are very, very important in driving value. Another example would be a 360 client. This is an internal IBM example where we're taking terabytes of data that we have on our clients, their buying behaviors, known entities within the client, and terabytes of information of public knowledge about clients, and doing the analytics and on the context of those two, merging those two to look for where is the opportunity with what clients in what geographies. Again, big data, but it's the context and the merging of the data where the true value comes out. Moving down then to that second level of visualization and visual analytics. We talked a little bit, Robert talked about security and analytics. This is huge data. 60 billion log events in just one case. Now, where do you think that is? Well, you think, my God, that must be a huge company, or country. That 60 billion log events is just my research lab in Yorktown Heights. 60 billion log events of interactions. And that sort of network there is what systems are talking to what systems over time and looking for abnormal behavior of transactions that might indicate embedded malware or an individual doing something they shouldn't. Enormous amounts of data. If you skip all the way then to the right, as another example, we now have the computational power to, from the molecular level up, model a complete beating human heart. Now, why is that important? Well, it's amazing graphically when you see this. But when you go to a pharmaceutical company, and they can now take that model and molecule by molecule attach that to a beating heart and look at the reaction, they can look for adverse drug behavior very, very early in the cycle of a drug qualification. That's a huge advantage for them. So again, the visual analytics coupled with deep insight at the science level is the second example. As we go deeper in the stack, these software-defined environments, we talked about it earlier. You know, the example of mobile provisioning. There's no way 12 million messages per second that you can go in and reprovision your storage and your networking and your servers to deal with that kind of data rates. So we need to dynamically provision that through software-defined environments, not just in networking or in storage or in servers, but across those. And I think we're probably the best position to optimize those software environments across the complete infrastructure capability. Let me take it to the right in the spirit of time here. Clearly, if we're going to be controlling through software these future clouds and future data centers, there has to be a way for human beings then to program that software-defined environment. We in IBM Research are working on the programming language for software-defined environments. So just as we developed Fortran and the basic programming languages for previous generations of programmable environments, we're creating the programming environment for software-defined environments in clouds and future data centers. It's the only way, again, humans are going to be able to interact with these massive, massive data centers. Going deeper then into this sort of five key technologies, data-centric systems. So again, where we've been is basically a processor-centric computing environment for the past several decades. And the way we improve performance in the processor-centric world was simply Moore's Law gave us higher frequency, gave us faster computers. That's sort of the simple-minded view of what happened. Well, guess what? A couple of things happened. The advances in performance and processor frequency with Moore's Law have basically tapered off. We have the fastest processor in the world in our mainframes at 5 gigahertz. Guess what? We're not going to be able to go much faster than that. Laws of physics don't allow it. We need to completely switch the design point now as we're reaching that limit and the data is exploding. And the way we're going to do that is through some of the technologies that are shown here. And let me just highlight a couple. Over on the left here, photonics. So again, it's all about bandwidth. The only way we can move these large data sets in these systems, even within the silicon, is to use light rather than pushing electrons through wires. So we have been able to, the first in the world, integrate complete transmit and receivers of optics through waveguides embedded in standard silicon process technology. So we will, in Rod's future systems, embed photonics right in the silicon, not as optical fibers between boards, but deep inside the silicon to move this massive data much, much faster. The second example is something we call an active memory cube. So here, basically, you'll see, again, if you look at some of the demos in these labs, you'll see that we're constantly bringing memory and processing closer together. Well, ultimately, we can build a cube which will have immense, immense processing capability. And the reason is that the data will never have to go through a normal bus structure, PCI, PCI Express. It will go through a single wire, probably vertically, between the memory and the processor. 20 watts per teraflop. To sort of calibrate you, The best supercomputer in the world, our BlueJean Q up at Livermore, is about 500 watts per teraflop. This thing will give us 25x power performance over the best computer in the world today. And this technology, again, is around the corner for Rod Systems. Hadoop we've talked about. Let me just talk about the one on the right. So graph databases, very, very important. So we've got relational databases, put numbers in columns, et cetera. Graph databases are for highly unstructured data, and it's a way to look for connections between data points. So if you have a massive social network and you want to analyze it, you use a graph database. And you're trying to find connections and tease out information from all of these data points that you have. These graph databases are extremely powerful in this world of big data. Today we're sitting at a few billion. We've done in our lab about 10 billion triplets or combinations of data. We know the technology and how we can get to a trillion of these triplets or relationships. And again, this is what's required if we're going to extract information out of context and relationships in these databases. So just as the relational databases were invented in SQL in these laboratories, the advances in Hadoop, the advances in graph databases, and brand new database technologies are going to be created out of our research labs for this new data-centric world. And then moving all the way down to the bottom of the stack in this new data-centric world are the core technologies themselves. First of all, from a memory standpoint, you know, DRAMs and HDDs and flash, very important now, but remember that curve I showed you before. We are producing data faster than we can possibly store it and collect it. We're just going to run out of hard disk drives and flash if we're going to try to store that tsunami that I showed you. So we need fundamental changes in the way we store the core bits of information. Things like phase change memory, racetrack memory, one of the demos that you'll see if you go to that particular lab. And of course, you know, we had an interesting little cartoon of moving atoms around, but it's not just making cartoons. It's fundamentally, if you have the ability to move atoms, you can build bits, 12 per bit, atomic structures that have memory with them. So we're exploring the very limits of what's it take to store a bit of information. That's the memory side. On the processing side, we had better do something that advances processing with all of that data. So we are pushing the absolute limits of silicon technology to its final limits, which will be, you know, today we're in the 20-odd nanometer range, single digit, 5-7, we don't know yet, nanometer silicon. These things will be tiny, tiny atomic wires. They will not be the kinds of transistors we have today. But we know there's a limit to what we can do in silicon, and it will probably be in the next decade or a little bit more. So we need to change material sets. One of the key materials we're looking at, along with other universities and players in this industry, are around carbon-based, carbon nanotubes and thin single-atom films of graphene, as it's called. We've built carbon nanotube transistors. We've built carbon nanotube circuits, very, very high performance at much, much lower power. And over this past year, we've managed to orient them and build significant density of carbon nanotube devices. So the whole world of carbon devices is very, very promising to replace silicon over the next decade or more. And then really the ultimate, which is a complete, no pun intended, quantum leap, is to move to quantum computing, where you're no longer just doing ones and zeros. You're using quantum mechanics, which gives you, you know, not 10x or 100x, but like many, many orders of magnitude, 10 to the 20, 10 to the 40 orders of magnitude. And in this technology, we've made great strides. This is a picture of what's called a qubit, a quantum bit. This is a picture of a planar device with three qubits on it. Now, I always like to bring things to show. So this is a three-qubit device in the center of this package, which we've built, set record speeds, record coherency, for those of you that are into quantum devices. But, you know, think about it. So this may look sort of crude, but if I was sitting here or standing here in the 60s and showed you the first transistor, you'd say, well, that looks pretty crude. And you'd never envision what happened over the next couple of decades. So this is three. Now you say, well, John, geez, you need billions of these like you need billions of transistors. You don't need billions of these. You only need about 100 of them. So if we can build about 100 qubits and put them in a package like this, in these containers, we'll have in a device like this a computer or an accelerator that will be tens of orders of magnitude faster than anything we're building today. And so we are leading the world in quantum computing research and trying to configure primitive systems that will have just transformative capabilities going forward. Okay, so now we're at that transition of we've got all this data, we've thrown all the technology at it we can. How do we really move into this cognitive era of computing? And of course, Watson is our flagship. And we are extremely proud not only of the technology, which no one to date after 2 years has even tried to announce, although I would challenge them to try, but we've also handed it off to Mike Roden, commercialized it working together at clients. But beyond the products that we're announcing and the work that we're doing, we've built a roadmap for where this system is going. So Watson sort of 1.0, as we call it, which Mike is commercializing, had enormous amounts of memory. It had the ability to learn, as you remember, and it had some judgment and perception capability, and still does. Where Watson 2.0 is going is to increase upon that and also bring in multimodal capability, which I'll show you in a minute, and begin reasoning, which is extremely important. And then Watson 3.0 will bring all of this to bear and perhaps even bring in some early signs of creativity, which, of course, was the demo we did out here around cooking. So what are the key technologies that are going to advance this roadmap? Well, one is this Watson PaaS, which we showed you out here. And we didn't go deep into the demo, but basically what Watson PaaS is doing is not answering a single question the way Watson 1.0 does, but it's really mimicking human reasoning. It's taking a set of unstructured observations, in this case a medical doctor observations, and it is in parallel doing reasoning and comparison. So sort of crudely think of it as multiple Watsons operating in parallel but talking to each other. That's essentially what humans do as they reason through problems. And in working with Cleveland Clinic, we have found that this PaaS capability or 2.0 capability can answer medical questions and diagnoses in a far superior way than Watson 1.0. So reasoning, huge advances. And then secondly, imaging. We know that, at least in healthcare and many other fields, we need Watson to understand image data. Today, if you put an image in front of Watson, it has no knowledge of what you've just done. So we need Watson to ingest and understand image data. You saw some of the work we were doing out here on cardiovascular work, right? Really advanced modeling of imaging data. By the way, it's a tough technical problem. It's tougher to understand an image technically, scientifically, than it is human language and text. But we've made huge strides, as you saw out here. This is another example beyond what you saw out there, which is coming from our HIFA research lab. This happens to be breast cancer, and these are tumors. Where we're looking at multimodal analytics against those tumors, not only shape and boundaries, but attenuation of ultrasound signals in this case. So if we can marry the text, unstructured information in Watson with these image analysis, now we've brought a new multimodal capability to Watson, which will again bring huge value to our clients going forward. And then lastly, as we move Watson even farther into the cognitive era, we are convinced that the whole mode of interaction with the human being is going to change. We are going to be able to have a Watson system which won't replace the human being, but will literally be able to sit at the table if you're a doctor looking at protocols, or if you're, sorry, Bob, in the legal profession. We'll be able to sit at the table and essentially have all of the world's known knowledge behind it to be able to present to you what it thinks. Or if you say, I think this is the best protocol for this kind of new cancer, Watson will say, well, did you consider this? And it will bring forward to the table information and analytics that there's no way a human being could have had access to, and will be able to present counter data to whatever your perception is of the potential solution. So the whole modality of interaction between a cognitive system and a human is going to change as we get this far into the cognitive era. Now, where do we go beyond that? So we'll build this capability, but even with all the great technology I showed you, we will run out of technical performance in our systems. We'll run out of data space, we'll run out of performance of even the best processing technology. So as I've shown before, we are looking at bio-inspired networks. This is a monkey brain, the neurological map of a monkey brain, or section of it. And you can see this is very interesting, at least for those of us that are into this. Humor me here. It's an incredibly complex set of synapses, long wiring across the bottom here. But it's not like anything we do today in a von Neumann system, as Dharmendra showed you out here. So we are working on studying these wiring paths and understanding how the logic and the memory work simultaneously in such a network. Because if we can move to such a network, it really brings tremendous capability for us. So as we showed you last year, we made some primitive devices which had some neural network capability in them, and we did some sort of simple-minded things. But as we showed out here in the demo, this year we will produce very low-power silicon devices that will have orders of magnitude improvement over our last, and we will start to approach the number of neurons and synapses in a human brain. This will allow us now to really experiment with building dynamic networks, like you saw in that neurological map, against very low power silicon. Now, we're not going to get to the 20 watts and the density of the brain, but we probably can get within a couple of orders of magnitude of power density of the brain. Now, we're not just trying to build such a thing. We're also working with leaders around the world to understand how the human mind works. In this case, you've probably heard of the Human Brain Project in the EU. It's a $1 billion project to fundamentally try to map the human brain and, through computer simulation, look at various problems, physiological, mental issues with the human brain, things that we're all familiar with. We are the IT partner in this project. So we want to learn with them in the EU about how the brain works, and when it malfunctions, why does it malfunction? Because we will learn about the computer architecture of the brain. So that's in the EU. Now, to sort of wrap this up, the message I want you to all walk away with is that this data is enormous. It is enormous. It's not like anything we've ever seen before. And so the technologies we need to use to do that, to process that information, are completely different than those we're working with today. It's going to be very disruptive, but those that can do it, I think, are going to reap huge value. Two pictures to sort of leave an image in your mind. The image on the left is, of course, it's the universe in the background, but this is the Square Kilometer Array Radio Telescope Project in South Africa. There'll be a piece in Australia and a piece up in the Netherlands. But this is the largest radio telescope array ever built. This array of telescopes will produce, this is an amazing number, 1 exabyte of data per day. 1 exabyte of data per day. That's more data than they can possibly store or hope to store. And so they're going to be throwing out probably 999 bits out of every 1,000 just to get down to a petabyte per day sort of range. Enormous amounts of data, but we're building these massive radio telescopes to explore the universe, which, by the way, is about 10 to the 23rd stars in the universe. We're building these immense radio telescopes to explore that universe. On the right side is what you saw in one of the demos. That's not a physical universe. That's a universe of data. And as you looked in the drug discovery demonstration out here, those weren't constellations. Those were connections, again, between proteins, molecules, looking for drug discovery cures for cancer. And the system, in a sense, the radio telescope to sort through that information and navigate that information are cognitive systems such as Watson. So we, again, in IBM Research are hugely advantaged to have the support of the corporation, but the total integrated capability from all the way from contextual high analytics data analysis down through core technology to address this problem. So again, this is probably the last time I'll speak to you. I want to thank you for coming to IBM Research and coming to Ominen. And again, hopefully it was a very valuable use of your time.